If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Just when we thought the Lindsay Clancy series was over, Friday brought a final day unlike anything I've ever seen. So now, we have another episode. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we unravel complex court cases, investigations, and true crime stories. From high-profile trials to the mysteries that still leave questions unanswered. We examine the facts, weigh the evidence, and explore the arguments shaping each story, just as the jurors do. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is The Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lindsay Clancy, The Trial, Part 7. When I released last week's episode, I made one final recording that Friday morning before hitting publish. I already had everything from closing arguments, the previous days of deliberations, and the jury's questions. I even added a final section covering the arguments made in court that morning. I closed the episode by telling you that I would give you the final update on court report, because at that point, I expected a mistrial and a relatively short update. But boy was I wrong. What happened in court after I published that episode was unlike anything I have ever seen before, and the aftermath is far more than I could cover in court report. So, our six-part series on the Lindsay Clancy trial has officially become a seven-part series, and we have a lot to discuss. When we left off, there was still one holdout. It was day 28 of the trial, and both sides had made their arguments about what they wanted the judge to do next. The Commonwealth suggested sending the jurors back to continue deliberating without any additional instructions. The defense argued that the juror, whom the foreperson described as unwilling to apply the law, had not been truthful when he told the judge that he could apply the law to the facts as instructed. Reddington wanted that juror removed. The prosecution pushed back, arguing that the note did not say that the juror was refusing or unable to follow the law. In the Commonwealth's view, the juror simply disagreed with the others about what constituted reasonable doubt or how that standard should be applied. The judge ultimately sided with the prosecution and refused to remove the juror. He explained that removing a deliberating juror should happen only under exceptional circumstances and with special precautions. He did not believe that those circumstances existed here, nor did he believe that the juror had clearly refused to follow the law. Instead, the judge said he would bring the jury back into the courtroom, re-instruct them on the law, and remind them that they were required to follow it, whether they agreed with it or not. Now that's where we left off on Friday morning when I published that last episode. But that is definitely not where this story ends. Immediately after the judge announced that he would instruct the jury to continue deliberating and follow the law, both sides had something more to say, and the courtroom got pretty heated. It began with Sprague asking the judge to instruct the jurors that any future notes not reveal information about their deliberations. Remember, jury deliberations are ordinarily protected, and the court generally cannot probe how individual jurors are voting or examine the substance of their discussions. And the judge agreed.
Here's what I was going to say. If there's any notes or any future notes, if there are any, you should refrain from detailing any of the actual deliberations and do not indicate where they stand numerically.
Then Reddington stood and addressed the judge again. He agreed that the substance of the jury's deliberations had to remain protected, but he was concerned that if the judge delivered that instruction too harshly, the foreperson might feel like she had done something wrong by sending the note. Given how delicate the situation had become, he wanted the judge to be careful about that part of the instruction. But while Reddington wanted the judge to be gentle when explaining what the jury should not do, he wanted him to be much more forceful when explaining what they did need to do.
I would ask that you not just give them, as I described it yesterday, a soft inquiry. Will you listen to my instructions? I would ask that you specifically direct their attention to proof beyond a reasonable doubt and re-instruct them on that forcefully.
I think I did that yesterday, didn't I?
Yes.
You did it yesterday. You did it soft. You didn't do it forcefully. And I'm asking
that
you do it
forcefully. What do you want me to do?
I want you to
get a brass band. I read the instruction as written by the SJC. The fact that I perhaps didn't give it my full inflection, I'm sorry about that. I'm not an actor. I've just given the instructions.
Reddington said that he felt the court was glossing over the real issue. In his view, the foreperson's note said that this juror would not apply the law of reasonable doubt when deciding the verdict. The judge responded, for the record, that he had not glossed over anything. He said he had spent considerable time thinking about the issue and had decided to re-instruct the jury on the law and allow deliberations to continue.
I'm going to just give that instruction, as I said, that they have to follow my instructions. I'm not going to reiterate the reasonable doubt at this point. It may come to that again as we go through it. And I'll try and give this with more pizzazz than I gave yesterday, I suppose. So with that, we'll bring the jury back in, and I'll ask the questions. I'll give those kind of that instruction, and we'll send it back out.
At 9:24 that morning, the jury was sent back to deliberate. 2 hours later, everyone gathered in the courtroom again. The jury had sent another note, and the judge read it out loud.
It is with a heavy heart that we report we are unable to come to a unanimous decision and will not be able to.
The judge then asked each side how it believed the court should proceed. Sprague said that because the judge had already given the Tui Rodriguez charge and the jury had deliberated extensively after receiving it, the Commonwealth believed a mistrial was now required. Now, that position was not especially surprising. The jury's previous note appeared to reveal that 11 jurors were prepared to reach some form of not guilty verdict, while only one juror remained unwilling to do so. With 11 jurors apparently favoring some form of acquittal, a mistrial was the best possible outcome still available to the Commonwealth. It kept the prosecution alive and gave prosecutors another opportunity to try the case. The defense, however, was not ready to give up. From its perspective, it would be far easier to continue trying to reach one remaining holdout than to bear the time, expense, and uncertainty of trying the entire case again. The Commonwealth has the resources of the state behind it, but a defendant's resources are far more limited. And in a second trial, the defense would have to begin again with 12 new jurors after apparently persuading 11 in the first one. And that's a daunting prospect for any defense team. So Reddington asked the judge to send the jury back and allow deliberations to continue. But the judge was not convinced.
Well, I would find that under Massachusetts case law and statutory law, the jury did not ask to be sent back, which it would be a possibility if they had requested it to be sent back to them. But under the statute and the case law, I don't feel I have any choice but to declare a mistrial.
Now, this was the moment I had been expecting. It was the moment that I assumed I would be covering in this week's court report. Honestly, it was the outcome I had predicted from the beginning of this trial. But what I was not expecting, and what I never could have predicted, was what happened next. We'll be right back.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
When the jury sent another note saying that they were unable to reach a decision, Judge Sullivan decided that the only option left was to declare a mistrial. But before he could even finish the sentence, defense attorney Kevin Reddington asked to be heard.
I don't feel I have any choice but to declare a mistrial.
Well, before you do, I'd like to be heard, Your Honor.
Reddington brought up a case that all of us are very familiar with, the Karen Reed case. If you've listened to 13th Juror for a while, you know that I began covering Karen's case in the summer of 2023, long before her first trial and before it became a global sensation. I have an entire season of this podcast dedicated to that case, titled Conspiracy in Canton, with roughly 60 episodes. Karen's first trial ended when Judge Beverly Cannoni declared a mistrial after the jury reported that it could not reach a unanimous decision. The mistrial was declared on every count, but afterward, multiple jurors came forward and said that while they had been unable to agree on one charge, they had unanimously agreed that Karen was not guilty of murder, the most serious charge against her. That created an enormous legal fight. The defense argued that the mistrial had been declared without giving the jury an opportunity to return verdicts on the charges that it had already resolved. If the jury had formally returned a not guilty verdict on the murder charge, double jeopardy would have prevented the Commonwealth from prosecuting Karen for that same charge again. So Reddington brought up Karen Reed's case because he saw an obvious similarity here. What if Lindsay's jury had already reached unanimous decisions on some charges or some possible verdicts, even though it remained deadlocked on others? Lindsay faced multiple charges, and each charge also included different possible verdicts. The jury might have unanimously rejected first-degree murder, for example, even if it remained divided over whether the appropriate verdict was a lesser offense or not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility. Reddington cited the Supreme Judicial Court's ruling in Karen Reed's case, which recognized that a trial judge has the discretion to determine whether a jury has reached verdicts on any individual charges before declaring a complete mistrial. So he asked Judge Sullivan to poll the jurors, to ask whether they had unanimously agreed on any charge or verdict. He was not asking the judge to question them about what was said during deliberations or why they voted the way they did, but he wanted to know only whether that final, unanimous decision had already been made on any of them. And if they had, Reddington wanted those verdicts formally recorded before the mistrial was declared. Because if any of those verdicts were not guilty, double jeopardy could prevent the Commonwealth from retrying Lindsay on those particular charges. But Judge Sullivan denied that request. Over the defense's objection, he said that he was going to declare a mistrial. Reddington was still not ready to stop fighting for his client. And this is where something happened that, y'all, I've never seen before.
Your Honor, while we're waiting for the jury, forgive me for raising this issue. I would ask that before you formally declare a mistrial, that the court afford us the opportunity to take a 211-3 appeal direct to the Supreme Judicial Court, single justice on this issue because of any number of issues that are of concern, others that have been addressed in the motions, the objections. But I further raise the issue of the American with Disabilities Act. I believe that this is a situation where there is a clear and present danger that this individual, for some reason, what it is, we don't know, but is taking a position that's intractable, regardless of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I want an opportunity to take an appeal to the single justice if the court will afford us that opportunity.
Reddington was asking for time to seek emergency intervention from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court before the mistrial became official. He wanted the state's highest court to pause the proceedings and decide whether Judge Sullivan needed to investigate the holdout juror more closely. Judge Sullivan agreed to hold off on formally declaring the mistrial, but only for 1 hour. Reddington now had just 60 minutes to prepare and file an emergency petition with the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, asking a single justice to immediately stay or pause the proceedings before the mistrial became official. Now, this is what we football fans call a Hail Mary. One last desperate throw with the clock running out. The clock started at approximately 11:30 that morning, and just before the deadline at 12:29 p.m., the defense got it filed. The 6-page petition was brought under Chapter 211, Section 3, which gives the SJC broad supervisory authority to step in and correct serious errors in lower courts when there may be no other adequate remedy. The defense also requested what is known as a writ of mandamus, In very simple terms, that means that they wanted the SJC to order Judge Sullivan to perform what they argued was his legal duty to protect the integrity of the jury. Specifically, they asked the SJC to order one of two things. First, require Judge Sullivan to question the identified juror about whether he was actually willing and able to apply the law. Or, second, prohibit that juror from participating in any further deliberations unless and until the judge questioned him individually and determined that he could follow the court's instructions. The petition argued that a juror's refusal to follow the law is not protected by the secrecy normally surrounding jury deliberations. According to the defense, that is personal misconduct, and once the foreperson alerted the court to it, the judge could not simply ignore it. The defense also took the argument one step further. They claimed that the juror's reported reasoning reflected a possible bias against people suffering from debilitating mental illness, because every criminal defendant has a constitutional right to an impartial jury. So the defense argued that even one biased juror would undermine the fairness of the entire trial. They cited cases involving allegations of racial or ethnic bias and argued that the same basic concern should apply here in the context of mental illness. When credible information suggests that unconstitutional bias may have entered the jury room, the court has a duty to investigate. And the defense did not mince words about Judge Sullivan's refusal to do that. The petition said that this was not merely an abuse of discretion. It was, quote, a failure to exercise discretion at all, end quote. Now, when I read this part of the petition, something clicked in my head. I remembered Reddington making this argument earlier in the day and referencing a jury question that had been asked before. Here's a clip.
If a jury consists of people and there's one person who is refusing to actually apply the law to the facts as determined for reasons that are not arising out of the case, but are personal to the juror's position regarding their review of their oath and how they should apply their oath. In other words, if it's personal to this individual, which I believe it is, based on the first question that you had.
This stood out to me because Redding specifically mentions this juror being unable or unwilling to follow the law, not because of something to do with the case, but because of something personal. Of course, we don't know at this point what was specifically written in that first question. We only know what has been read into the record in open court. But it's clear from these arguments that Reddington believes the juror is showing a personal bias, not just an inability to agree with the other 11 jurors. Their final argument was simple. This mistrial is still avoidable, but only if the SJC intervenes before Judge Sullivan officially declares it and dismisses the jury. The Hail Mary had been thrown. Now everyone inside that courtroom had to wait to see whether anyone at the SJC would catch it. We'll be right back.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
That afternoon, the emergency petition went before Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Justice Delilah Arguez Winlant, who was sitting as the single justice assigned to hear the request. The justice heard brief arguments from both sides over Zoom. Sprague began by walking her through the timeline, the jury's notes, Judge Sullivan's repeated instructions, the Tui Rodriguez charge, and finally, the foreperson's notes concerning the holdout juror. She started with the first note and explained how Judge Sullivan had handled it.
They sent in a note stating a member of the jury is unable to follow the instructions regarding reasonable doubt. How should we proceed? So then Judge Sullivan brought them in for individual voir dire, asking each individual juror if they were still able to follow his instructions. Each juror answered in the affirmative that they were. The judge credited those answers and then brought the entire jury back into the courtroom together and re-instructed on reasonable doubt.
Sprague then explained that later that same day, the jury sent another note.
It says that the juror has made statements acknowledging doubt, but refuses to apply it to the verdict as the law states. This is why we cannot come to a unanimous decision.
After receiving that note, Judge Sullivan sent the jurors home for the evening and instructed them to return Friday morning. Sprague then brought Justice Winlett through everything that happened since they returned. After hearing from the Commonwealth, the justice gave the defense an opportunity to respond. Reddington had enlisted appellate attorney Dana Goldblatt to help prepare and argue the emergency petition, so she addressed the justice on Lindsay's behalf. Goldblatt explained that Reddington had asked Judge Sullivan to conduct an individual voir dire of the identified juror to question him privately and determine whether he was willing and able to follow the court's instructions, but Judge Sullivan declined to make that inquiry. That was when Goldblatt stepped in to file the emergency petition in one final attempt to prevent the mistrial. Goldblatt argued that this was not an ordinary disagreement over the evidence. According to the four-person's note, one juror had acknowledged doubt, but refused to apply it as the law states. The defense believed Judge Sullivan needed to determine whether that juror was disagreeing in good faith or refusing to follow the law before ending the trial. Then everyone waited. Those of us following the case waited in anticipation to find out what would happen next. I must have refreshed my phone every 3 minutes, waiting for an update. And finally, around 2:15 that afternoon, we got our answer.
Counsel, it's my understanding that the SJC issued their order that the emergency request for relief was denied and that the temporary stay is lifted. And so it would be my intention at this time to call the jurors back in. And as I indicated to you before, to declare a mistrial.
The justice denied the emergency request. With no order from the SJC stopping him, Judge Sullivan returned to his original decision and again announced that he would declare a mistrial. Now, most attorneys probably would have accepted that the fight was over, but Kevin Reddington is not most attorneys.
I understand, Your Honor, and at the risk of incurring the wrath of the court, I'd like to raise an additional issue just for purposes of the federal law.
Reddington placed another objection on the record, arguing that declaring a mistrial under these circumstances violated Lindsay's constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. He maintained that once the foreperson alerted the court that a juror was allegedly unwilling to follow the law, that Judge Sullivan had a duty to investigate. In Reddington's view, the juror either needed to be questioned or removed, and he also cited federal law and procedure supporting a court's authority, under certain circumstances, to excuse a deliberating juror for good cause. Depending on the applicable rules and the judge's findings, a court may then allow the remaining 11 jurors to return a verdict or replace the dismissed juror with an alternate and begin deliberations again. So Reddington asked Judge Sullivan for a hearing so that the issue could be fully examined. Now, once again, the judge denied his request. And finally, after one of the most extraordinary days that I've witnessed in a courtroom in many years, the mistrial was formally declared. Judge Sullivan brought the jurors back into the courtroom to let them know.
All right, members of the jury, at this point, I'm going to declare that the jury is deadlocked, and I'm going to declare a mistrial.
But before dismissing them, the judge had some final words for the jury.
I'm kind of a history buff. And during World War II, Winston Churchill was the prime minister for England, when England pretty much stood against Nazi Germany alone. And so Churchill oftentimes had to talk to the citizens and say, "Let us brace for our duties." And I always liked that phrase. And I thought of that phrase when all of you were agreeing to be on this jury. That you agreed to brace for that duty. And each one of you knew how long the case was going to go. You knew how difficult the case was going to be to listen to facts-wise. But still, you braced for that duty. And I just kind of wanted to also let you know, I watched every day, day after day, week after week, all of you performing that duty that you braced for. And I just kind of wanted to let you know, I understood how hard everybody worked in this case. I understood that you all gave everything you could, and probably more than you thought you could. And so on behalf of myself, I just want to thank you so much that you should be proud for what you did. You braced for that duty. You performed that duty. And I just kind of wanted to thank you on behalf of myself and behalf of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
Judge Sullivan also offered parting words to the three trial attorneys. He acknowledged how difficult the case had been and thanked each of them for their hard work and effort throughout the trial. Outside the courthouse, members of the press had gathered and were waiting to hear from both sides. Plymouth County District Attorney Tim Cruz spoke first. He acknowledged that one of the first questions would be whether the Commonwealth intended to try Lindsay again. But he said that decision would not be made on this day. He planned to meet with his team, evaluate what had happened, and address the next steps later in open court. Cruz also thanked the jurors for their service and acknowledged the tremendous difficulty of the case that they had been asked to decide.
But in the end, I understand that this has been an emotional trial for everybody. It's emotional for the Duxbury community. It's even emotional for you members of the media. But in the end, I bring it all back to the child victims in this case, Cora, Dawson, and Callan. This was and has always been about getting justice for those three little babies. We're here at this courthouse today because those children are not.
Cruz said the noise surrounding this case may have been louder than in many other prosecutions, but he maintained that his office treated it as it would any other case. He said children had been murdered, and it was his office's responsibility to seek justice for them. He also acknowledged that postpartum depression has affected countless women and families, and said he sympathized with those struggles. But he maintained that the Commonwealth's investigation showed Lindsay was in control of her actions when she killed her children. And he insisted that neither the public attention nor public sentiment would determine what his office did next. When Cruz opened the floor for questions, he was immediately asked why he would not discuss the possibility of a retrial when that decision would ultimately belong to him. But before Cruz could fully answer, a woman in the crowd interrupted.
You only cared when the kids were dead. Why don't you care about the mother?
Amen.
You cared when they were dead.
Can't you make that decision right now? Vote out.
As he continued trying to answer questions, people in the crowd continued to shout and heckle him.
You know, I'm not going to stand out here and listen to this.
Then Cruz was asked about something that had been the subject of discussions, debates, and frustrated social media posts throughout the trial. The criticism that prosecutors Shannon Buckingham and Jen Sprague had handled this extraordinarily sensitive case with a lack of sensitivity. Critics pointed to the prosecution's treatment of Lindsay's suicide attempt, its questioning about Catholicism and mortal sin, and what many viewed as a dismissive approach to serious mental illness. Those arguments may have been intended to establish criminal responsibility, but many viewers believed that the way they were presented lacked compassion. One reporter's question is difficult to hear, but I want to play it along with Cruz's response. In case you can't make it out, the question was essentially this. You had 11 jurors who apparently did not accept the Commonwealth's case. What do you say to the people who felt that this entire prosecution was insensitive?
DA Cruz, you had 11 jurors that didn't necessarily believe your case. What do you say to those people who felt that the whole prosecution was insensitive?
Was what?
Insensitive.
Insensitive?
Insensitive.
Insensitive is killing three children. Insensitive is ignoring those facts. We have an obligation to stand up for those people and seek justice and make sure the defendant gets justice and make sure they get justice. So if people can't understand that, I don't know how I can answer that question.
Later that afternoon, Kevin Reddington also addressed the press. And as you might expect, he didn't hold back.
It's a very sad case. Cruz knows that he was crushed. He doesn't have a case. He doesn't have to stand here and say that he's advocating on behalf of the victims and then look down to see what their names are.
Reddington pointed out that during a 7-week trial, witness after witness described Lindsay as a loving mother, a devoted nurse, and a person who had been desperately struggling. He said no one who actually knew her had anything bad to say about her. In his view, the only people who portrayed Lindsay differently were the two prosecutors and District Attorney Cruz. Reddington said that Lindsay continues to grieve for her children. He explained that whenever someone talks about who Cora, Dawson, and Callan were, Lindsay smiles. Not because she's minimizing their deaths, but because she wants people to remember their lives. He turned his attention then to the jury.
Where do I begin to thank these jurors? Minus one. The forelady of the jury, I was so proud when she indicated, after the judge sent them back to deliberate, indicating that one of the person would not listen to the law, and then she came back immediately with the question stating that this is one individual, it was 11-1 for an acquittal, and one individual who recognized that there was reasonable doubt and refused to apply the law.
Reddington said that the other jurors had been robbed by one man, whatever his agenda may have been. He accused that juror of taking 7 weeks from 11 people whom he described as attentive, dedicated, and wonderful. Then he added, "I hope that guy can sleep well at night." When Reddington was asked how Lindsay was doing, his answer was simple, not good. Still, he said that she would be ready if the Commonwealth decided to try her again. Reddington also acknowledged that this case had affected him more emotionally than most of the cases he had tried. He said Lindsay had become like a daughter to him, and when a reporter asked what he might do differently in a second trial, Reddington responded with complete confidence. He said, "Why would I do anything differently? I won the case." Reddington's comments outside the courthouse were raw and sometimes emotional and made just minutes after the trial ended. But by Tuesday morning, he had more to say. In his first national television interview since the mistrial, Reddington appeared on Good Morning America and spoke about the holdout juror, what could happen next, and just how personally invested he has become in Lindsay's case. He addressed the harsh comments that he made about the holdout juror on Friday. Reddington clarified that he does respect any juror's right to disagree with the other 11 and to stand firmly behind an honestly held decision. His frustration, he said, came from what the foreperson reported, that this juror acknowledged having doubt, but refused to apply that doubt according to the law. To Reddington, that was not simply a juror viewing the evidence differently. He believed it was a juror refusing to follow the court's instructions. Reddington was also asked about his boast outside the courthouse that he had crushed the prosecution's case. He admitted that some of what he said was bravado, fueled by emotion after a grueling 7-week trial. But he did not back away from his belief that the defense had won over the jury, pointing again to the apparent 11-1 split. When the conversation turned to what comes next, Reddington said that he would be willing to sit down with District Attorney Tim Cruz and discuss a possible resolution. But his position remains that Lindsay belongs in a hospital, not a prison, and that she should continue receiving psychiatric treatment. Then Reddington made the most unexpected statement of the interview. He appealed directly to President Donald Trump and asked him to consider pardoning Lindsay. Now, there's one major legal problem with that request. Lindsay is being prosecuted under Massachusetts state law, and a president's pardon applies only to federal offenses. President Trump does not have the legal authority to erase state murder charges or to order the Plymouth County District Attorney not to retry her. Reddington later acknowledged that limitation. So, practically speaking, what he appears to be seeking is not a presidential pardon in the traditional legal sense, but maybe the president's attention and influence. He wants President Trump to use his platform to bring national attention to Lindsay's case, postpartum mental illness, and the possibility of resolving this case without sending her to prison. It was an extraordinary request, but after everything that happened on Friday, perhaps it was also a fitting continuation of Reddington's approach. If there is any avenue left to explore for his client, no matter how unconventional or unlikely, he's going to explore it. We'll be right back.
Chumba.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Plus, terms and conditions apply.
For days, nearly everything we knew about what happened inside that jury room came through the foreperson's notes and the attorney's interpretations of them. But that changed this week when several jurors began speaking publicly about the trial and revealed, in their own words, what happened during nearly 40 hours of deliberations, including how the vote broke down, why 11 of them believed Lindsey should not be held criminally responsible, and what ultimately prevented them from reaching a verdict. And their account gave us our clearest picture yet of what was happening behind that closed door. Now, rather than go through each interview separately, I want to look at the themes that remained consistent across their accounts. And the first was pretty clear. These jurors did not believe the Commonwealth proved that Lindsey was criminally responsible beyond a reasonable doubt. Remember, the jury was not being asked to determine whether Lindsey killed her children. That was never disputed. They were being asked whether the Commonwealth proved beyond a reasonable doubt that at the time, Lindsey did not suffer from a mental disease or defect that prevented her from understanding that her actions were wrong or from conforming her behavior to the law. According to the jurors who spoke out, the prosecution did not meet that burden.
We weren't trying to figure out if she murdered the children. She did. And she's admitting that. We're trying to figure out, did she know right from wrong at that time? And with everybody saying she loved her children so much, and everything proved she loved her children, from her journals to her mother-in-law, everything proved that she loved her children, so she had to have snapped and not known what she was doing. To me, that it was proof that she didn't know what she was doing.
You know, sitting through all that evidence, sitting through all that witness testimony, I thought she was not guilty by reason of insanity.
Several jurors described a noticeable difference between the case presented in the Commonwealth's opening statement and the one that it argued in closing. They felt that prosecutors began with one theory, but as testimony unfolded and some of their claims were either unsupported or contradicted, even by their own witnesses, the theory appeared to shift. The jurors pointed to claims about Lindsey's motive, the suggestion that she had merely hung from the window rather than making a serious suicide attempt, and other arguments that they believed were undermined by the medical and forensic testimony. For them, those inconsistencies did not resolve the question of Lindsey's mental state. They created even more reasonable doubt.
Things that they were saying was all disproven by professionals, and sometimes their own professionals. So that brought huge reasonable doubt to their case.
Some of the jurors were also critical of the way the Commonwealth presented its case. They described the prosecutors as cold, biased, and at times unprofessional. Now, I mentioned earlier in this episode that that was a recurring theme in many online discussions, and it was something that D.A. Cruz was even asked about during the press conference. So learning that some of the jurors perceived it that same way cannot be ignored, especially if the Commonwealth plans to retry the case.
So I found it to be biased right out of the gate. I found them also to be kind of unprofessional and just without a heart. And for me, that right away, I was like, okay, where is this going? Right from statement one, mm-hmm. There is no compassion in this courtroom right now, which I guess is expected of a prosecution, but I thought it was very cold. Mm-hmm.
They also noticed that the prosecution did not call anyone who knew Lindsey to say that she had been a bad or uncaring mother. Instead, witness after witness described someone who deeply loved her children before experiencing a devastating mental health decline. The jurors said that they were also troubled by how much time the Commonwealth spent showing graphic autopsy photographs. Lindsey had already admitted what she had done, so the nature of the children's deaths was not the disputed issue. And these jurors understood that the evidence was horrific, but they felt the repeated images appealed more to emotion than to the legal question they had been asked to decide. Some also reacted strongly to the questioning about whether Lindsay and Sue Clancy were practicing Catholics and whether murder was considered a mortal sin. And when it came to the expert testimony, at least two jurors specifically identified Dr. Avram Mack as ineffective. They described him as smug, insincere, and not believable. By contrast, they found the defense experts more credible, and some were especially moved by Sue Clancy's testimony and her decision to continue standing by her daughter-in-law. One juror said the prosecution appeared to do itself more harm than good because it never fully addressed the totality of what Lindsay had been experiencing, the severe decline in her mental health, her repeated attempts to find help, and the many medications that she had been prescribed. To these jurors, the evidence showed that Lindsay loved her children, and because there was no history of abuse, cruelty, or resentment toward them, they believed something catastrophic must have happened in her mind that night. But when deliberations began, the jury was not immediately united. Several jurors initially leaned toward a guilty verdict. At least one entered the jury room believing that Lindsay was criminally responsible for what she had done.
Originally, I felt as though she was guilty and she was criminally responsible for it. And maybe I still believe that in a certain way. I think that this was a woman who, you know, she was not mentally healthy. She was someone that was in the throes of a significant mental health crisis. So I really just felt like she was so deep in it that she couldn't see her way out.
But over the following days, they began laying out the evidence, reviewing exhibits, rereading the law, and challenging one another's interpretations. The jurors described difficult and sometimes very heated discussions. There were strong personalities in the room, and the holdout was not the only person who initially struggled to see the case from another perspective. But the others continued engaging with one another. Quieter jurors began speaking up. Some stood and passionately explained how they viewed the evidence. They returned repeatedly to the definition of reasonable doubt and to the Commonwealth's burden of proving that Lindsay was criminally responsible. One juror explained that she changed her position because, at the end of the day, there was simply too much doubt and too much gray area. Through that process, jurors who had initially leaned guilty changed their minds, and eventually, 11 of the 12 agreed that the Commonwealth had not met its burden and that Lindsay should be found not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility.
Because at the end of the day, there's so much doubt. You know, the prosecution didn't have a figurative, smoking gun. There was not a single moment throughout that presentation, that case, that you could say, oh, yep, 100% I'm certain she did it, or that she didn't do it. There's too much gray area. And eventually I just felt like the only way to get justice for Cora Dawson and Callan and Patrick and her parents and anyone else that was closest was to get her the help that she desperately needed. And there's no way she's getting that help 100%.
But according to the jurors who have now spoken, the final holdout was different. According to their accounts, the holdout explicitly acknowledged that he did not know whether the prosecution had proven its case. They said he acknowledged having doubt, but would not apply that doubt when choosing a verdict.
I mean, he had reasonable doubt. He admitted he had reasonable doubt after we watched that video of the interview. I think that's when it was. He admitted he had reasonable doubt. And I started filling out the forms. I was so excited. I actually, there were three forms I had to fill out, and I started filling them out. I wrote my signature on each one, and then he said, but I'm still not going to say that she's not guilty by reason of insanity.
It was definitely frustrating. Mainly frustrating when he explicitly said, I don't know if the prosecution or the defense proved their case.
Now, to be clear, the defense doesn't have a burden of proof, so they don't have to prove their case. But the prosecution does. If the Commonwealth did not meet that burden, the law required a verdict finding Lindsay not criminally responsible. They were all very clear that their frustration was not simply because he reached a different conclusion. They understood that jurors can honestly disagree. If one juror reviews the evidence, applies the law, and remains convinced of guilt, that is a legitimate hung jury. That's how the justice system works. But these jurors said that that's not what happened here. They asked the juror to point to the evidence supporting his position, but according to them, he could not identify a witness, exhibit, or specific piece of evidence that explained why he believed that Lindsay was criminally responsible.
Several times I would ask him to show us, like, evidence or, you know, describe a witness testimony that helped to prove what he was saying, and he couldn't. There wasn't a single piece of evidence or witness testimony that he used to prove why he was thinking the way he was, which is why we ultimately sent in that note. Otherwise, like, there's nothing wrong with somebody having a completely opposite opinion. Like, that's, you know, that would be a hung jury. That is our justice system.
And it's not simply because of the fact that he had an opposing view or this person felt like she was guilty. It was the inability to kind of back that up with any logic.
They said that he remained focused on the horrific fact that Lindsay had killed her children and could not move past that fact to consider the narrower legal question of her mental state. The other 11 jurors said that they tried everything they could think of to reach him. Some became angry. Some cried. Even the quieter members of the jury stood and pleaded with him to remain open-minded and give the acknowledged doubt the weight required by law. But they said there were times when he would not engage with them at all, including moments when he scrolled through his phone while they were speaking. And then there was one moment that I still kind of can't believe happened. According to one juror, the holdout took one of the exercise bands admitted into evidence, wrapped it around a water bottle, and then pulled on it. The juror describing this said that he was stunned. In his view, they were not supposed to conduct their own experiment or play detective.
I was shocked. It didn't make any sense to me. Like, we're not in here to play detective, or it's not a game of Clue. Like, this is serious. I asked him why are you doing that?
That's a band that was used to strangle a child.
It's disgusting.
That incident raises its own questions about what jurors may and may not do with admitted evidence during deliberations. But more than anything, I think the other jurors appeared to have viewed it as another example of the holdout, focusing on how the children were killed rather than the question that they were legally required to answer, whether Lindsay was criminally responsible when she did it. Eventually, the other 11 felt that they had exhausted every possible approach. They were tired, defeated, crying. They felt like he wasn't listening to anyone. After the judge delivered the Tui Rodriguez charge, they returned to the jury room and tried again. They dissected the instruction, talked about the importance of listening to one another, and once more attempted to work through the evidence. But still, nothing changed. That was why the foreperson sent the note saying that one juror had acknowledged doubt, but would not apply it as the law states. And based on what these jurors have said now, they believed that this was no longer an ordinary disagreement. They believed that the holdout was refusing to follow the law and that Judge Sullivan should have investigated.
He was very arrogant. He really did not take anything that anybody said.
We spent so much time with this man, and, you know, that's only... there's only so much you can say, and we had some quiet jurors that got up and passionately spoke from their hearts to him. We all made a scenario, you know, put yourself in this position and just listen to them. We went from anger to, all right, we're crying, we're asking you to please just be open-minded and look at the doubt that is, there's so much doubt. Stop forgetting about Lindsay killing her kids. Everybody knows it. The world knows it, but look at the doubt. That's all we need to do to get this woman the help she deserves. And at that point, we were like, yeah. I mean, some of us in the end even said, I'm not coming back tomorrow. There were some of us that were like, I'm not coming back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back.
Ch-ch-ch-ch-chumba.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The jurors who spoke out continued to believe that Lindsay was not criminally responsible that night. Some have said that they do not believe that she should be tried again, and some have said that if the Commonwealth does retry her, they intend to be inside that courtroom supporting her. Their interviews give us something that we didn't have when the mistrial was declared, a clear understanding of how 11 jurors reached the same conclusion, and why they believed the 12th was not simply disagreeing with them, but refusing to apply the law that they had all sworn to follow. They may have left the courthouse without a verdict, but the jurors who have spoken publicly do not appear uncertain about their own conclusions.
I think if they tried the trial again the way they did, I think 9 times out of 10, I think a jury would come back with not guilty by reason of insanity.
The mistrial ended the court proceedings, but it did not end what these jurors carried home with them.
I can't close my eyes without imagining those kids, but...
These jurors spent almost 2 months hearing intimate details about one family's life, Lindsay's psychiatric decline, and the deaths of Cora, Dawson, and Callan. They saw pictures that most people will never see, and they spent nearly 40 hours carrying the responsibility of deciding what it all meant under the law. But there was one piece of evidence that seemed to affect every juror who discussed it: Patrick's 911 call. Each of them described that call as one of the most disturbing and unforgettable moments of the entire trial. They remembered the reaction inside the courtroom when it was played. People were crying. Others appeared physically ill. And an entire room was forced to listen as Patrick discovered what happened to his children in real time.
I will never be the same after a 911 call.
It was horrible. I felt like being sick, actually.
It's something that I will never not hear. If I think about it, it was the most horrific thing. And when we heard it again in the jury room, we were crying again. We were just like, my God, the desperation, the despair in his voice was, again, it's something that will stick with me. Mm-hmm.
The 911 call, I'll never forget that. That was frightening. I've never heard something like that, like a scream like that, come out of someone's mouth. It's horrifying.
Now, this brings me to a topic that I've been reluctant to even discuss on this podcast: the conspiracy theories that Patrick is responsible for the deaths of his children. I have not wanted to waste time discussing these theories because they have no merit. They are unsupported by the evidence, and frankly, I have not wanted to give them airtime that they don't deserve. But the accusations have continued to spread. And when the trial ended, the jurors found out about the conspiracy theories surrounding Patrick. They each believed, however, that there was no possible way that Patrick could have faked the anguish that they heard in his voice. Several of them said that if people spreading conspiracy theories about Patrick had listened to that call, they would understand why the jurors found those theories impossible to believe.
Like, after the trial, I saw all conspiracy theories about how Patrick did it and that he somehow convinced Lindsay that she had done it when it was really him. And all I could think was that if these people could have heard that, like, visceral, blood-curdling scream, I don't think I could name a single actor or actress that could have performed that the way he did. And not that he performed it, but, like, I will never be the same after that.
It was genuine. It was absolutely genuine. There's no doubt about that.
Those damaging theories have continued to flood social media. And this week, Patrick's legal team decided it could no longer remain silent. Attorney Howard Cooper issued a forceful statement saying that Patrick and his family have been subjected to what he called a relentless, escalating, and destructive defamation campaign. According to Cooper, influencers, minor celebrities, and conspiracy theorists have promoted false claims that Patrick was somehow involved in the deaths of his children, along with other accusations that his attorneys described as vile and completely baseless. Now, we're not going to get into all of these theories or all of the details here. There's no credible evidence presented during this trial that implicated Patrick in the deaths of Cora, Dawson, or Callan. Lindsay's defense did not accuse him of being involved, and the evidence established that he was away from the house when the children were killed. Kevin Reddington even shut down those theories in his media interviews this week. Cooper said the online campaign has now created real-life threats to Patrick's reputation, his livelihood, and even his life. His legal team warned that enough is enough. They said that law enforcement had been notified and indicated that they were prepared to pursue every appropriate avenue, including legal action, to hold the people spreading these accusations accountable. According to the statement, Patrick's goal is to stop the misinformation so he can return his attention to what matters most, preserving the memories of Cora, Dawson, and Callan, and supporting women and families facing perinatal mental health challenges. And I think it's important to remember something here. Patrick has already endured an unimaginable loss. People can have strong opinions about Lindsay and the prosecution and the defense or the outcome of this trial. But turning Patrick into the subject of unsupported conspiracy theories does not bring anyone closer to the truth. It only causes further harm and pulls the focus away from the three children whose lives should remain at the center of this case. We'll be right back.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So where does the case go from here? The parties are scheduled to return to court on September 29th at 9 a.m. for a status and trial assignment hearing. And that is when we may learn whether the Commonwealth intends to retry Lindsay, and whether the two sides are discussing some kind of negotiated resolution, and when a second trial could begin. Judge Sullivan has indicated that he would like any retrial to happen sometime in the fall, although that would be an unusually fast turnaround for a case this large and complicated. A second trial would also come with advantages and risks for both sides. Retrials are often thought to favor the prosecution because prosecutors have now seen the defense's entire case. They also know which witnesses were effective, which arguments connected with jurors, where their own presentation created confusion, and what weaknesses the defense was able to exploit. They can adjust their strategy, streamline their case, and prepare better responses the second time around. But a second trial does not automatically produce a conviction. Andrea Yates is one of the most relevant examples. Her name and her case came up repeatedly during Lindsay's trial because of the striking similarities between the two stories. Yates was convicted at her first trial of killing her children, but that conviction was later overturned. At her second trial, another jury considered much of the same evidence and found her not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, next week, I plan to release a bonus episode featuring a very special guest, and together we will examine both the Yates and Clancy cases, as well as some of the psychology and psychiatry behind them. So, while a retrial would give the Commonwealth an opportunity to correct its mistakes and strengthen its presentation, it would also give the defense another chance to reinforce the arguments that apparently persuaded 11 jurors the first time. But before any second trial begins, the defense plans to pursue two different legal arguments that could potentially stop it. First, Reddington says he plans to file a motion to dismiss the charges on double jeopardy grounds. Ordinarily, double jeopardy does not prevent a retrial after a hung jury because the inability to reach a verdict creates what the law calls manifest necessity for a mistrial. But the defense plans to argue that there was no manifest necessity here because the mistrial could have been avoided. According to Reddington, Judge Sullivan could have investigated whether the holdout was refusing to follow the law, removed him for good cause, or determined whether the jury had already reached unanimous decisions on any of the charges. Appellate attorney Dana Goldblatt is expected to handle these appellate issues moving forward, and she has said that she believes the defense has a very strong double jeopardy argument because of what she considers significant mistakes in the way that the trial ended. And that doesn't mean that the court will agree. No formal verdict was returned, and the jury repeatedly reported that it could not reach a unanimous decision. But the defense now plans to argue that the mistrial was unnecessary and that forcing Lindsay to stand trial again would violate double jeopardy. Now, separate from that argument, the defense has now filed a renewed motion for a required finding of not guilty under Rule 25. Now, this motion does not depend on the mistrial being improper. Instead, it asks Judge Sullivan to examine the evidence from the trial and decide that, even when viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it was legally insufficient to prove that Lindsay was criminally responsible beyond a reasonable doubt. Remember, once mental illness was at issue, the Commonwealth had the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt either that Lindsay did not suffer from a mental disease or defect, or that despite that illness, she retained the substantial capacity both to appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct and to conform her behavior to the requirements of the law. And the defense argues that the Commonwealth never got there. They point out that all six forensics experts agreed that Lindsay was suffering from mental illness on January 24th. They disagreed about exactly what that illness was and whether she was psychotic, and ultimately whether she was criminally responsible. But according to the defense, the existence of serious mental illness itself really wasn't disputed. They also mentioned that the 11 jurors were prepared to find Lindsay not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility, while the remaining juror acknowledged having doubt but refused to apply it. But importantly, the defense says that 11-1 split is not the legal basis for this motion. A hung jury is not an acquittal, and ordinarily the Commonwealth is allowed to try the case again. But instead, they're asking the judge to independently decide that the prosecution's evidence was legally insufficient. Now, the stakes here are huge, because if the judge granted this motion, it would be an acquittal, and Lindsay could not be retried. If the judge denies it, the Commonwealth can continue moving toward trial number two. And there could also be additional motions, a possible plea agreement, decisions about which charges the Commonwealth would pursue, and questions about whether another impartial jury can be seated after the extraordinary amount of publicity surrounding this case. So right now, we still do not know whether Lindsay Clancy will face a second trial, whether this case will be resolved in some other way, or whether an appellate court will step in before either of those things can happen. But before we end this series, I want to bring our focus again back to the three people who should never become lost in all of the legal arguments, jury notes, press conferences, and breaking news updates. Cora, Dawson, and Callan. They were not just names attached to three murder charges. They were three children who were deeply loved. And throughout this trial, we heard about their personalities, their routines, their relationships with one another, and the joy that they brought to the people around them. Whatever someone believes about Lindsay's criminal responsibility, three innocent children lost their lives. Nothing decided in a courtroom can undo that loss, and no verdict or mistrial can ever fully measure it. This trial asked jurors to decide what was happening inside of Lindsay's mind on January 24th, 2023. But at the heart of that question were three beautiful children whose lives mattered far beyond the way that they died. For now, this is where the case stands. No verdict, no final resolution, and far more questions still ahead. But if the last several days have taught us anything, it's that this story is nowhere near over. I know there will be much more to come, and when it does, we will be here to work through it together. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. It helps more listeners discover the podcast. And if you know someone who would find this case as fascinating as you did, share this episode with them. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.